Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
A day after the earthquake, a race against time in Haiti.
When the road gets dark.
We have every single dozens and dozens of volunteers from other UN peacekeeping missions who are offering their service, want to go to Haiti to help.
People can help by caring about what happens in Haiti, by paying attention, by holding all of us accountable. Don't let our story die when it goes off the wires.
With tens of thousands of lives in the balance, the rescue operation begins. It's down to faith and time in Haiti.
And have a little faith in me.
On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday or Thursday, January 14th, and the takeaway is how much time does Haiti have? What are the rescuers going to need there? The clock is ticking for an estimated 3 million people facing water shortages and public health threats.
I mean, that's nothing to sniff at. I mean, when you're talking about traumatic injuries, literally, it's yep. down to hours. Yep. Let's get right to the top story this morning, the horrific sounds of Port-au-Prince. For thousands, it's another night spent sleeping outside amid the ruins and cries for help. The death toll remains a question mark, but everyone seems to agree it's at least in the tens of thousands. Because of a lack of heavy equipment, the search for survivors continues by hand at a frantic pace.
We need more people down here! We need more people down here!
But above the cries of sadness, many are gathering in public squares or empty streets or in churches, and they're trying to make sense of the madness around them.
The United States has taken the lead in launching a massive response in this hemisphere. Assessment teams began arriving last night. An aircraft carrier with supplies and 2,000 Marines is expected to arrive this afternoon, with other Navy warships en route. Aid agencies around the world are mobilizing as well. A search team from China arrived this morning. The World Food Program is flying in 100 tons of food. Flying in supplies, though, has been hamstrung because the control tower at the airport was destroyed. Former President Bill Clinton is the United Nations Special Representative for Haiti. He says the country desperately needs large quantities of just a few things.
What we need now is food, water, supplies for first aid, and shelter.
Water is the first priority. People could survive over a week without food, but they may die in days without water. Joining us now is Millery Polonais, who's a professor of American Studies at New York University. He's a Haitian scholar. What is Haiti's political response in a disaster like this? People are holding on, waiting for help. Does the Haitian government politically rise to the occasion in situations like this, or do people tend to become more cynical and bitter about their predicament?
Well, good morning. It's really two Haitis going on here. There's Haiti the state and Haiti the nation. Historically, Haiti the state has never been really an institution that has helped out the masses. It's always been very difficult for it because of, you know, economic issues and financial issues, things of that nature.
Well, that dual personality is really what we're going to explore all hour with you. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. If you want to donate to the massive relief effort in Haiti, you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
And looking at the markets, Asian markets were mixed. European indices up. Futures are flat, though. The Dow will get underway at 10,680. The S&P opens at 1,145 and the NASDAQ at 2,307.
Lots to talk about. Later this hour, we're going to take a look at low-cost, low-tech innovations that are going to help Haiti now, fuel that comes from sugarcane, straws that filter water, and wallpaper that actually can help prevent disease. And in the wake of Haiti's devastating earthquake, we're asking all of our listeners, what's the responsibility of the world's richest nation to one of the world's poorest nations? Should America be shouldering more of the financial burden in this hemisphere, or should relief be left in the hands of relief organizations? What's your take on the complicated history between the United States and nations like Haiti? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we'll explore the challenges relief organizations can expect in the complicated political situation we've just talked about in Haiti. Good morning, everyone. We want to get you fully updated on what's going on in Haiti. The official death count is just beginning in that nation, and various estimates say tens of thousands of people may die when the final count is put together. There are even estimates as high as 100,000, but search teams and health assessment teams are looking and trying to figure out where the most damage is and where the people are most threatened. And, of course, for people who are alive and survivors and people who are injured, time, as we are saying, is running out as the relief operation begins. Lucy Tondreau, you're a Haitian community advocate in Miami, Florida, joining us from Miami. When do you ship out for Haiti?
As soon as we have clearance. As a matter of fact, we were hoping to do so today, and unfortunately we haven't gotten clearance yet. As soon as we have the clearance, I will be one of the few people that are able to go and help.
There's a real relief traffic jam there because the dropping-off point is Miami for so many people who are headed to Haiti. Let me give you a sense of what you're going to see when you finally arrive in Port-au-Prince. This is from the Miami Herald's Francis Robles reporting in Haiti for your local public radio station, WLRN. Listen to this.
I don't want to give the impression that every building in Port-au-Prince has collapsed. That's certainly not the case. You have a very busy, vibrant city with everybody running around. And then let's say you have a flap where there's 30 buildings. Three of them may have collapsed. And maybe there were 30 people in those three buildings. So that you have a trail of dead bodies scattered throughout the city. You might just be walking down the street, and then there are three or four bodies laid out with white sheets over them on the sidewalk.
So, Lucy Tondreau, it's a grim situation there, but hardly lifeless. What have you heard about what you expect to find?
Well, I know what I'm expecting to find, since each time there's a calamity in Haiti, I'm always there on the ground helping. It's the feeling of helplessness right here in South Florida that is the hardest part. We know what to expect. We want to put our grain of salt in order to help. And we know that from watching the news, the bodies are laying everywhere in Port-au-Prince, the buildings that have collapsed, and mostly the people in despair, not knowing where to go, not able to find their loved ones, and it is heartbreaking.
Right. Well, you are with a medical response team leaving from Miami-Dade County as soon as there is clearance. As you say, Lucy Tondreau, stand by for us there in Miami. Millery Polonais, who's a professor of American Studies at New York University, we talked to you just at the top of the hour. That powerlessness that Lucy talks about, you know personally. You have family in Haiti who you still maybe have not heard from.
Yes, we our family has our cousin, unfortunately, who passed away, Azu, and we're looking for five other family members.
And, you know, when we were talking off air, and I was reminded of a very evocative soundbite I heard last night on a public radio program where you look at the sky, it's beautiful. You look down at the ground, it couldn't be more awful. Yeah. You said to me this morning, we're trying to figure out why Haiti.
Yeah.
That's a real feeling among Haitians. Explain. Help me to understand that.
Why Haiti? I mean, many Haitians take so much pride in their history, and the history goes back to the Haitian Revolution, obviously slavery, and obviously going as early as to the 20th century U.S. occupation of Haiti. So we think about all this stuff, and so we think about all the kind of obstacles that have been in our way in order to achieve and progress, and they've always been whether economic, natural disasters, something that is happening, political disarray.
And Lucy Tondreau, you know the history of Haiti as well as anyone. What makes things difficult in a relief operation? You've had a lot of experience.
Well, what makes things more difficult is the lack of infrastructure in Haiti, to lack of preparedness in Haiti also, and the fact that the people of Haiti have never been able to count on their government, in order to look for help. That's why everybody's looking into the international community to come and seek help. The people of Haiti, after the four hurricanes that hit Haiti back-to-back, they have that potentiality to rise back whenever there is sadness in the country. And it is difficult for us here in the United States to understand people with nothing are able to live and be happy on a daily basis. So it is very difficult for us here, not being able to get in touch with loved ones, not knowing exactly what's going on. Are they okay? There's no communication. We were not able to get through Haiti for the past 2 days. Hopefully today we'll have some phone lines.
And, you know, as you both point out, Lucy, you and Millery Polonais here in the studio, the Haitians are used to, have grown up with a history of not being able to rely on the government. That infrastructure you have learned not to rely on. I'm wondering, and again, the U.S. is at the head, the tip of the spear of the relief operation here in this hemisphere. There will probably be more resources mobilized from the United States than anywhere else in the world, nevertheless. Does the U.S. have some complicity in that history where Haitians have learned not to trust their government, Millery Polonais? Lucy's agreeing with you, too. Lucy, yeah. Stay on the line.
Without a doubt. I mean, from going back to the Haitian Revolution to Haiti wasn't recognized once it achieved its independence until 1862 by the United States, going to 1915 to 1934, U.S. occupation, moving up to various issues in which the U.S. has propped up, supported various governments from Elie Lescot to Estime to Duvalier. So they've always been a part of Haitian foreign policy and have always had their hand in all of this.
So the relief operation, you know, not to get involved in a lot of U.S. bashing guilt, but nevertheless, I mean, we're a part of that history. We ought to be a part of the solution. 877-8 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. What do you believe is America's role in this hemisphere? Lucy Tondreau, before we go, why don't you take us out? You have some impressions?
Yes, I do. Not only the occupation of Haiti, but the army that was trained not to serve the people, but to kill people in Haiti. That was part of the heritage that we've got also after the occupation in 1934, after the United States left.
And each of these things, means that the people have difficulty having faith in the very infrastructure that they must rely on now for aid. And, of course, the priority is to get clean drinking water to the people and aid and food in these periods when time is running out. Millery Polonais, you're going to stay with us. Thanks so much. Lucy Tondreau, good luck in Haiti. I hope you can ship out today.
Thank you so much.
Lucy Tondreau is a Haitian community advocate in Miami, Florida. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the stories we're following.
As we've just been discussing, thousands of people in Haiti are spending a second night sleeping outdoors, fearing more aftershocks following the earthquake that devastated parts of the country on Tuesday. Haitian radio host Carol Pedra spoke to CBS about the aftershocks via Skype.
You see, right now, there's aftershocking. You see, it's shaking. Well, I don't know if you can feel it, but it's checking right now.
In the capital, Port-au-Prince, correspondents for our partner, the BBC, say the night has been punctuated with the sounds of people crying and praying. They describe children sleeping alongside dead bodies on the grounds of one hospital. They say many streets are lined by corpses covered with white blankets. Meanwhile, aircraft bringing rescue crews and specialist equipment have been flying into the capital. Medical and food aid is being distributed in some areas. Here's Rajiv Shah from the U.S. Agency for International Development.
The goal of the relief effort in the first 72 hours will be very focused on saving lives. That is the president's top priority.
Planes bringing teams with medical and food aid from a number of countries have started to arrive at the capital's airport, but there's no coordinated relief effort yet.
In other news today, the U.S. says it's monitoring what's described as a credible threat from al-Qaeda in Yemen against the U.S. homeland. That's according to two senior officials speaking with CNN. One source says officials came across with information relevant to aviation while following up on that Nigerian terror suspect in the failed Christmas Day bombing attempt. In Washington, there'll be another meeting on health care legislation today, that after yesterday's marathon meeting between the president and the Democrats.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. In just a minute, we'll go to Washington. Did we find out anything new when the bankers came to explain themselves on Capitol Hill yesterday? Stay with us.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first takeout on the news comes from Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent. And while all this discussion of the situation in Haiti has been going on, there were negotiations for a final health care reform bill that's dominating the situation in Washington. And it's all about a disagreement among Democrats, not between Democrats and Republicans. The administration is at odds over some Democrats, and Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is here to explain it all. Good morning, Todd.
Hi. Good morning, John.
So what are they disagreeing on?
Well, high-cost health care plans we've talked about, and of course that's a major issue between Democrats. The president has said he likes the Senate plan, which is to tax high-cost health plans, get revenue to pay for this bill, and at the same time discourage employers from purchasing these so-called Cadillac plans that cost a lot. But it's not the only issue. The Senate also wants these. Remember, we've been talking about these exchanges, these sort of marketplaces, right, where you can buy health care and people compete for prices, drive down prices. The Senate wants these to be bifurcated, a separate one in each of the 50 states. The House says no way. It has to be national or else it won't have any market clout. So these are some of the main issues. There are others. But the president is really involved now. You know, John, throughout this whole debate, Democrats have been complaining in Congress that the president is kind of remaining aloof. You know, you got Joe Lieberman running around and Ben Nelson from, yep, Nebraska running around and Blue Dogs, and the president's not giving any direction. Well, he is now. Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and some other leading Democrats went to the White House yesterday for what was supposed to be an hour-long meeting on health care, stretched to over 8 hours, mostly with the president. Now, we understand that he was in and out of the room dealing with world leaders on the earthquake situation in Haiti as well. But a lot of that time was with the president. Meanwhile, labor leaders also in the West Wing in a separate room, while the Democratic leaders are in another room, possibly a bit of a shuttle diplomacy situation going on because labor's so very upset, you know, about these negotiations.
Sure. Well, the tax on Cadillac health plans would go directly at unions. We've had the AFL-CIO president even address that issue on this program. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
And now for a takeout on business, leaders of the four big Wall Street banks were called to Capitol Hill to testify before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Hours and hours of questioning. They seem to take very little responsibility for the human error that contributed to the crisis.
Looking back on this now, would you look back on some of the financings as negligent or improper?
In the context of the world that we were in, I think those were very typical behaviors.
Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. That's Lloyd Blankfein, the head of Goldman Sachs, saying that those were typical behaviors that led to the crisis. Why does that make me uneasy?
Morning, Celeste. Well, if you listened carefully, he did not answer the question.
No.
The question was, were those negligent behaviors? And he did not say if they were negligent or not. He said they were typical. And that is what you're hearing among the survivors of this crisis. The leaders of these banks, the ones that did not fail, the ones that are still here, are saying, look, this was what the world was like. This is what we were doing. This is what everyone was doing. And we did it less because we survived. The ones who really did it badly failed. And that's how they answer
the
questions.
So what's the old, I was speeding officer because everybody else was going the same rate of speed?
That is the tone. That is the tone. Now, there's going to be a lot more hearings from this commission. Their goal is to get to the bottom of the financial crisis. They have a year to do it. The head of the commission put it yesterday. He said that we are a proxy for the American people, their eyes, their ears, and possibly also their voice. So they're taking this seriously to dig in and figure out what went wrong.
So had the answers from the bankers changed, or maybe the questions from the lawmakers?
What I feel is different. You know, a year ago, there was a hearing in Washington with the 8 leaders of the biggest banks that took the bailout. And I covered that. And that hearing was all about asking them for advice. How do we end this crisis? How do we keep you alive? How do we stabilize the markets? And there was a real shift in tone. Now that the markets are stabilized, you are seeing a lot more tar and feathering and a lot more hard questions, in part, I think, because leaders in Washington think they can question people now because they've stabilized the system, and also in part because, as a public, we've all learned more in the past year about what really happened, and I think we'll learn even more over the next year. I know that we're planning to continue deep reporting on what caused this.
Well, we'll see if that any of that leads to reform, though. Louise Story, finance reporter for The New York Times.
We turn now again to Haiti. And you're hearing there the sounds of workers by hand trying to remove rubble to free survivors in a nation that's waiting for heavy equipment to even begin the rescue operation in earnest. Perhaps 3 million people are at risk for problems associated with contaminated water, the lack of food. Millery Polonais, professor of American Studies at New York University, give me a sense of the sort of visual picture of the difficulties, say, bringing in water by truck or bringing airlifting in food supplies and getting it distributed.
Well, for a long time, the roads in Haiti have not been well. I mean, going 15 to 20 miles may take, up to 2 hours. Heavy traffic, mass migration of people, so it's a heavy populated area. Now with the earthquake, it's even more time.
And your cousin, who I believe didn't survive the earthquake, was 2 hours away.
So 2 hours away.
I mean, but that was not by the crow flying 2 hours away.
Right.
There was no hope when his house collapsed.
Exactly.
And is there anything that the aid operation can do to make that easier? Is there any sort of quick rebuilding that is possible here? Or really, are the people going to have to come to the aid rather than the aid come to the people?
Well, for the people, they must come. They have to work first. And they've been doing it thus far. If we wait on people from the outside, it's not going to happen.
And
as
quickly as you like. Yeah. And what's been the track record on hurricanes in Haiti? Has the aid worked there?
It's always been sketchy. For a long time, corrupt governments have taken the money that's been given. Other times, it's worked.
All that will be tested, certainly, this time around. Millery Polonais, professor of American Studies at New York University. Coming up, what is the responsibility of the world's richest nation in response to the devastating earthquakes that have rocked the Caribbean nation of Haiti? You can give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. It's a war on Al-Qaeda, says Barack Obama. What does journalist Peter Baker think about that?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, Bush felt it in his gut. Obama thinks it in his head. We're going to talk about the approach to the war on terror in Obama's first year with journalist Peter Baker. First, let's check on the top stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Haitian leaders believe the death toll will be at least in the tens of thousands in the aftermath of the earthquake. This Port-au-Prince man who was loading bodies onto a truck made this desperate plea.
Too many people die. We need help, international help.
Yeah.
We ain't got
there
no help. We need urgency. We need emergency.
Yeah.
There's no help, no hospital, no electricity, nothing.
No food,
no water, nothing. There's too many people dying.
A massive worldwide aid mobilization is now underway. Dennis McDonough, the White House National Security Council Chief of Staff, says the first step was taken yesterday by a U.S. assessment team.
It's a question really of being certain that, for example, the airstrip can handle all the stuff we want to send in there. So we're doing things like that, making sure that we have a full assessment of what's happening on the ground.
An aircraft carrier with supplies and 2,000 Marines is expected to arrive this afternoon with other Navy warships en route. Another 3,500 paratroopers are on alert at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, available to prevent looting and control crowds. The first of them could be on the ground as early as tomorrow.
The rescue teams that are in the country right now are looking for survivors in the mountains of rubble. They're providing food, medical care, and shelter, and restoring electricity, all to try and save lives. Bill Horan, the president of the group Operation Blessing International, says there's an urgent need right now for clean water.
We set up these small plants that process 10,000 gallons per day. We can take water from a river, from a pond.
If you want to donate to the relief effort needed in Haiti, you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org. Check out the markets now. Asian markets mixed today. European indices are up right now. Gold is trading up. The futures are flat at this point, and the Dow will get underway at 10,680. The S&P opens at 1,145, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,307. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
After the attempt to explode a bomb on an American plane on Christmas Day, how and when President Obama became a focus in the storm of media coverage that followed it. The New York Times Washington correspondent Peter Baker fills out those headlines for us. He has an in-depth look at Obama's approach to terrorism as opposed to that of the administration that came before him. It's in this week's New York Times Magazine. It's the cover story called, tellingly, Obama's War Over Terror. Peter Baker joins us now. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. How are you?
So you talk in the article a lot about the difference in responses between the Bush administration to terrorism and the Obama administration. And you start, one of the places that you start is with the response to the Christmas Day bombing. Can you tell me what you learned from that?
Well, you know, you saw that President Obama was reluctant to rush out to the cameras after the attempted bombing on Christmas Day. His style is to wait for more information, to think about things before, you know, giving it what he would worry would be a too abrupt reaction. But even then, that causes a political problem for him. His very deliberation, which is a relief to many people who were tired of what they saw as sort of swaggering President Bush, strikes others as a sign that he doesn't really take the issue as seriously as he ought to. That's the source of criticism from former Vice President Cheney, as an example. But, you know, President Obama obviously has taken terrorism seriously. He just has a different approach than President Bush's. A lot of the policies are still pretty much the same. There's not a huge difference in policy, at least from the second term of President Bush to the new Obama administration. But the tone is different. The language is different. The way he approaches it as a conception is different.
You know, let's talk a little bit about the similarities first. One of the things that I found interesting was that you said Barack Obama knows the chances are good that there will be a successful attack on the United States sometime during his tenure. And he also knows that if he drastically changed policies from the Bush times of the Bush administration, that that's what people would point to.
Right, that's exactly right. And a lot of the things that he found on his desk at the Oval Office when he came in almost a year ago, he is more or less kept. You know, by the time that President Bush left office, some of the harsher and more controversial elements of his counterterrorism strategy had already been moderated, either because of pressure from the Supreme Court or Congress or news media disclosures. So what President Obama inherited was a different, much more consensus approach than the first term President Bush. For instance, President Obama has kept the military commissions. Now, he's added some more procedural safeguards, but he's kept those. He's kept the national security letters. He's kept the power of rendition. He has argued for some of the same state secrets cases that President Bush had argued for. And he's also going to continue to keep at least several dozen terror suspects locked up without trial or charges. You know, there are some important differences. He's going to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-described mastermind of 9/11, to New York for trial in a civilian court. But largely, President Obama has kept going the same direction and accelerated the same evolution that was already going on in the last 2 years of the Bush administration.
But you do point to a difference in that you see, say, Obama sees this as a war with al-Qaeda, not a war on terror.
Right. He has a different sort of rhetorical approach and a different tone than the last administration. He feels that war on terror, first of all, terror to him is a tactic, not an enemy. He calls it a war on al-Qaeda. But that does lend itself to the criticism that you hear a lot from Republicans, that means he doesn't think he's at war, that he is considering this to be a law enforcement problem rather than, you know, a great confrontation. He would argue that's not the case. He would argue that the point is to make clear that America is at war with a small group of extremists rather than with the larger Muslim world, which is the way a lot of Muslims around the world had perceived it in the last few years.
Well, Peter Baker, let me just pose this question to you then. As Obama likes to say, let's be clear. Because Obama seems to be holding the tools of rendition, of possible domestic surveillance, do you think he's more inclined to pursue those tactics in his war on al-Qaeda or more inclined to resist using them than President Bush?
Well, the argument would be is that he maintains that power but will use it more wisely, more judiciously, less less radically, perhaps, in the previous administration. That would be the argument. You know, what his critics on the left would say is that is a problem because, the inherent power in the executive should not be based on who is the executive. It should be based on what we think are the proper roles of each part of government in terms of its power over its own citizenry.
One of the things that also struck me was you talked about how Obama feels that the Bush strategy elevated the terrorists, gave them more power than they deserved, and it allowed them, you said, to change American society without their ever carrying out a single successful attack. What does Obama mean with that?
Well, I mean, you know, let's face it, even if the underwear bomber had succeeded, that he would have killed perhaps 300 people. That's a terrible, terrible tragedy. But there are something like 14,000 murders in this country every year. So they have a disproportionate impact with the attack. President Obama wants to find a way to keep from making them the singular threat to the nation equivalent to the Nazis or communism during the Cold War.
All right, Peter Baker, White House correspondent for The New York Times. That article is the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine. Coming up, returning to the earthquake in Haiti, we're going to be talking about low-cost, low-tech innovations that could help the people of Haiti now. And we're asking our listeners, what is the responsibility of the world's richest nations, American included, in response to the earthquake that rocked the Caribbean nation of Haiti? Do you think Americans should be shouldering the bulk of the financial burden there? Should we relieve the relief effort in the hands of the organizations who are focused on that? What do you think? What is our responsibility? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And we turn now back to the situation in Haiti. And joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Cameron Sinclair, Executive Director and co-founder of the organization Architecture for Humanity. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning, guys. How
and,
are you?
Great. And we've been talking about the need for clean drinking water and medical care in the early going in Haiti in the aftermath of the earthquake this week. But there's also a need for shelter, and you've dispatched, I gather, a ground team of your sort of SWAT team architects to begin the task of rebuilding Haiti and Port-au-Prince. Describe, first of all, why Haiti needs architects right now and what architecture can do for humanity in a disaster.
Well, you know, we were recently in Haiti just a few months ago, ironically, to do a couple of buildings around post-disaster recovery. And while we were there, we were kind of horrified by the quality of construction, or so to speak, the lack of construction, and the need for kind of sound and strong buildings. And, you know, now more than ever, we need to look at the not just the recovery process, but the full reconstruction process, and how do you build housing stock and community structures that are not only for the next 5-10 years, but to mitigate for future disasters.
How do you involve the community in that process so that this kind of thing doesn't happen again in the rebuilding process?
Well, one of the big mistakes in the reconstruction process is kind of a top-down solution, which is you kind of fly in a team, you have a solution, you start implementing that solution without the community involvement. Architecture for Humanity is really a community-led reconstruction process where the families and the community are part of the design process and construction process as we go forward. Because without the buy-in and the empowerment of the community, there's no ownership. So it's vital to have their involvement.
And you're focused on schools and large-scale structures as much as housing at this point. Is it really true that part of your motto is you go where Anderson Cooper of CNN doesn't go?
Sort of. You know, part of that is that we tend to direct our services where communities have really been overlooked, both by governmental and international government agencies. So certainly after Hurricane Katrina, we were in the kind of towns and villages that were really hit by Katrina head on and didn't get the attention of the media. So we tend to find those communities that have been overlooked and find ways we can help them best.
What are the challenges you're facing right now before we go?
There's a lack of materials, there's going to be a lack of construction availability, and quite frankly, within about 3 to 4 weeks, the world's eyes are going to turn away from Haiti, and we're going to forget the sort of damage and the long-term need for solutions. And what happens is funding dries up, and anything you raised in the first few weeks is really what you've got to play with in terms of reconstruction. So it's raising a large amount of money very quickly so that we can look at not just the first month, but the first year and the first 5 years of the rebuilding process.
And that's the mission of Architecture for Humanity, focusing now on the rebuilding effort and creating a sustainable community that involves people in Haiti in that rebuilding effort. Cameron Sinclair, Executive Director of Architecture for Humanity, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, the benefits of sophisticated low-tech solutions in high-risk conflict zones like Haiti after the earthquake. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But first, a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Help continues to arrive in Haiti in the form of aid flights into the capital. An American aircraft carrier as well, the USS Carl Vinson, is due to arrive off the coast later today. Former President Bill Clinton, the United Nations Special Representative for Haiti, is telling people that the country needs food, water, supplies for first aid, and shelter in the first wave of relief efforts. And the former president also paid tribute to his colleagues at the United Nations who died in the earthquake. At least 150 UN employees are still missing.
A substantial number of United Nations employees, some of the finest people I have ever worked with, died in Haiti, along with a large but as yet undetermined number of Haitians.
There's also the problem of security in Haiti with very little resources given to law and order. This Haitian man says someone is in his house, but with police focused on the rescue effort, there's nothing he can do about it.
Now we have somebody here.
There's some person inside the house.
We can't find him. We don't have a loader to take them out.
Google's announcement that it may pull out of China has sparked a lot of speculation on the future of an open internet, but there's been little word from the Chinese government until today. Joining us is BBC Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg. Chris, what did we hear from China?
We had a foreign ministry spokeswoman asked seven times about Google at her regular weekly briefing. I would say her response was pretty predictable. She said that China opposed any form of cyber attack, such as computer hacking, so rejecting the suggestion that China's government was responsible for the attack on Google. And she said the internet was open in China and China wanted to develop it, was making efforts to create a favorable environment for that, and that any internet firm was welcome to do business in the country as long as it followed the law.
Well, Google has decided to pull out of China. Is there room for negotiation here? Could Google change its mind if China says the right things?
Well, let's be clear. Google has said that it will stop self-censoring the internet searches. Now, if China doesn't agree to that, then it will pull out. But they haven't even sat down yet and had the face-to-face meeting. So it's too early, really, to say exactly how this is going to go. But it's very difficult because some people here argue it's impossible for Google to leave China. The economic downsides of such a move would just be too large. But it's equally going to be very hard for the government to relax its internet restrictions. So it's very hard to see how they'll resolve this.
Stuck between a rock and a hard place in Google in China. Thanks so much. That's BBC Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg. And today is the second day of hearings into the financial crisis. Attorney General Eric Holder is expected to tell the investigating panel that the Justice Department is using every tool at its disposal to fight the financial crimes that contributed to the meltdown. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
For our technology segment today, we want to talk about the sophisticated technology that can be brought to bear in a disaster relief situation and the surprising solutions that sometimes are more low-tech than high-tech. And to talk about this from both the beginnings of the supply chain to the places on the ground where people need the most help immediately, we've got Amy Banzart, who's a PhD candidate at MIT's D-Lab, which creates technologies for the developing world. She's on the line from Nicaragua. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
And Mark Belinsky joins us from here in New York. He's co-director of Digital Democracy. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark, let's talk about the beginning of the supply train. When people want to get aid in, when they want to mobilize, often there's a kind of a glut, a traffic jam of communication backlogs where people have difficulty finding out information about loved ones, connecting with families inside countries. What are the high-tech tools that are available to help coordinate this effort and to keep gluts and backlogs from clogging the system?
Absolutely. There's so many many people who want to come in and help, and it's important to make sure that there's not sort of too much information happening on the ground. And so we've been working on this solution called Ushahidi, which is a coordinated crisis map, where we get to pull in all the maps that are coming out on the ground, then overlaying it with the information as it comes out, locating where the buildings are that are collapsed, where there are people who still need help, and making this a place where people can text messages in so that we get response immediately as it's happening.
So it's a kind of a disaster, global disaster, frequently asked questions site that allows people to get answers there without clogging the system.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. Have you been able to make something like that work here in this Haitian disaster?
Yeah, so we've been working on an install, and you can actually go see it right now. It's haiti.ushahidi.com. And so we've been working around the clock, really drawing out the maps that are that can work right now. So there's not a sophisticated Google Maps system, you know, so it's really building that from scratch. It's taking brand new satellite photography and crafting out a new map, and then pushing in data as it emerges, emailing it in, transcribing from voicemails, and texting it in.
Oh, that's fascinating. Amy Banzart in Nicaragua. Now, they're talking about, and Bill Clinton just said as recently as yesterday afternoon, that clean water is what's needed on the ground in Haiti right now. I'm thinking, okay, so we fly a bunch of water filtration systems, park them at the airport, and start handing out water. Is that the solution typically?
Frankly, I'm not an expert on disasters. I'm an expert on the technologies that are used sometimes in disasters and sometimes in everyday life. Haiti has a hard time, people have a hard time in Haiti getting access to clean water in the best of times. But certainly both the ability to test water and clean it very quickly and affordably and is ideal. I would not recommend putting stations just at the airport, but throughout the entire region where water can be cleaned.
Well, and, Amy, what kind
I'm really
of...
I'm not familiar with how bad the infrastructure is in terms of whether pumps and wells and that sort of thing are still available for people or if water is going to be even more of an issue.
Well, I understand that, but you actually have been a part of developing tools that actually bring the filtration system into the neighborhoods at the family level where people can actually do some of the filtration and testing themselves. Describe.
Absolutely. So we have one set of devices that allow you to test the water to determine if it's clean, and typically equipment for that costs between $800 and $1,200, and we have tests that cost about $10 as an upfront cost, and then individual tests cost about a few cents each, so orders of magnitude more affordable and available. Secondly, when you do the test, you need to keep the samples that you take of the water warm for 24 hours at human body temperature in order to determine bacterial growth rates, and you sniff before and during your D-Lab work has developed a test that requires no electricity, is very robust, and costs around $50 as opposed to the traditional tests, thermal battery-powered models that cost between $1,500 and $2,500. So again, we're talking about orders of magnitude of more affordable, simpler, more robust.
Is the strategy for relief operations and for the development of these kinds of technology in the developing world shifting towards more low-tech, low-cost solutions, or is there some resistance to adopting some of these ideas that you're describing?
Well, a lot of our innovations and efforts are so simple that people are taken aback. We're used to high-tech solutions here, and even within MIT, while D-Lab has a good name, people think, well, you know, these problems aren't actually hard because this solution is so simple, when in reality, there's incredible constraints on material resources because we're trying to get so affordable, so radically affordable, and therefore they're very sophisticated solutions, even though they come out looking very simple.
Interesting. Amy Banzart is a PhD candidate at MIT's D-Lab, working now in Nicaragua to develop technologies for the developing world. Mark Belinsky is co-director of Digital Democracy. What lesson do you think we're likely to learn in Haiti, Mark, before we go?
I think we're really going to see how a coordinated effort from the international realm can really be used so that when communication technology gets up and running on the ground, it can instantly just start working.
All right. Mark Belinsky is co-director of Digital Democracy, talking about the advantages of using high-tech communication systems to reduce backlogs of information flow in disasters like the Haitian earthquake. Thanks so much.
And the map that he was talking about is actually available at our website, thetakeaway.org. Today we're asking our listeners, what's the responsibility of the world's richest nations in response to the devastating earthquakes in Haiti? One listener wrote to us at our new website, thetakeaway.org, that the Haitian people need the United States to help them more than ever. Just a small portion of what we spend on wars could save the lives and futures of one of our closest neighbors in this hemisphere. And they go on to say, I can see why people in that country do not put their strength and energy into doing more to improve the island. People must live from day to day, never knowing when the next calamity will happen. There are many Haitian people here in New York City, and my heart goes out to all of them. I was relieved to read that relief for Haiti is already being organized by this country. What's your take? Do you think we should be shouldering the burden of the relief organization or not? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.